that's been our show. Thanks again for listening, and thank you again, caller. I'm sorry I forgot to get your name for that great request from Half Japanese. Great band.
Thank you, caller, and thank you, listeners. Feel free to call or text next time. We'll be back next week, same time.
All right. Until then, good night.
Good night.
The station you're listening to is powered by AzureCast, the free and open source software that makes web radio simple. If you're hearing this message, your station's ready to go. Just add new music to your playlists. If you need help or to learn more about AzureCast, visit azuracast.com.
This has been a rebroadcast of our August 12th program.
The right turn is an elite phenomenon. It's not a turn towards conservatism, but rather a turn towards a kind of reactionary jingoism, which is quite the opposite of conservatism. Furthermore, the policies are highly unpopular, and we have extensive poll results which indicate that from the beginning of the Reagan Revolution, the public has been strongly opposed to every major program.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on The Right Turn. The United States is an imperial power. After World War II, it emerges as the global hegemon. The right turn accelerates under Reagan and continues today. Its salient features are a massive transfer of resources from the poor to the rich, an increase in state power, and an aggressive interventionist foreign policy enabled by a huge military apparatus with bases all over the world. The empire's activities are largely hidden under layers of deceit and subterfuge. A sophisticated propaganda system keeps the public basically unaware. No one has done more to expose actual U.S. domestic and foreign policy than Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist who has been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. The New Statesman calls him the conscience of the American people. He'll be 97 in December, and though having health setbacks, he continues to inform and inspire people all over the world. During Alternative Radio's 40th anniversary year, we'll be airing some of Chomsky's classic presentations. The one you're about to hear was recorded in 1986 at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And now, Noam Chomsky on The Right Turn.
Well, to begin with, what's the right turn? This is associated conventionally with the Reagan administration. What are the Reaganite programs which supposedly constitute the right turn? Well, they basically fall into three related categories. First, there are the programs which have involved a rather substantial transfer of resources from the poor to the rich. Second program is a large increase in intervention, subversion, international terrorism, and general gangsterism and lawlessness. Third, there has been a huge increase in the state sector of the economy, this in the traditional American way through the military system. The military system serves as a state-guaranteed market for high technology waste production, with armaments, in other words, or from another point of view, it serves as a device, as a means of state industrial management, a means of forced public subsidy for the most advanced sectors of high technology industry. In fact, the ratio of state expenditures to gross national product has risen more rapidly under Reagan than at any time since the Second World War, and this fanatic Keynesianism of the Reagan administration has had the predictable consequences, such as the huge deficit. This vast increase in the intervention of the state in the economic system under Reagan has also coincided with other measures taken to strengthen the state relative to the citizenry, measures to protect the state from public scrutiny, to block public discussion, attacks on civil liberties, and so on. Well, if you think about these measures, and they are the Reaganite measures, it's clear that the so-called right turn is not a turn towards conservatism, quite the contrary. There happen to be very few conservatives in American politics or in American society, and old-fashioned conservatives, like Robert Taft, for example, would turn over in their graves at the way the term is now being used. It is now being used to refer to fanatic Keynesianism, to lawlessness, and to extreme advocacy of welfare state measures, although now a welfare state for the rich, not the poor, as state policy is reshaped even more than it usually is to benefit the privileged and to serve their needs. So this is nothing like conservatism. Let me make a general observation, which I think is worth bearing in mind. In political discourse, most terms are used with a kind of a technical meaning, which is divorced from and often the exact opposite of their ordinary meaning. Conservatism is a case in point, but there are many other examples. So take, for example, the term democracy. The way that's used in political discourse is to refer to a system of elite decision with occasional ratification on the part of an irrelevant public. If segments of the usually irrelevant and apathetic public begin to organize and to try to participate in some meaningful fashion in shaping affairs of state, that is not democracy. That is called a crisis of democracy, as liberal elites in fact call it, and it's a crisis that has to be overcome by various means. In El Salvador, you overcome it by death squads. At home, you overcome it by more subtle devices. Or take the term free enterprise, which is used to refer to a system of public subsidy and private profit, which is organized by massive state intervention in the economy, as under the Reagan administration. Or take the term defense against aggression, which is used naturally for aggression, as, for example, when the United States attacked South Vietnam in 1962. This was referred to as defense against aggression. In fact, it was called defense against internal aggression by the liberal hero Adlai Stevenson, who explained that, in fact, this was what was happening there was aggression by South Vietnamese. The U.S. Air Force at that time was bombing them out of their homes and into concentration camps, and we had to defend them against internal aggression. These, incidentally, are not my terms. They're their terms throughout. Or take, finally, the term national interest. The term national interest is used in political science and so on to refer to the special interest of privileged elites. The national interest often happens to refer to something very costly to the general population. And since the national interest refers to the special interest of privileged elites, naturally the term special interest has to have a comparable interpretation. It has to refer to the population, and it does. If you look at political discourse, you'll notice that national interest refers to the special interest of privileged groups, and special interest refers to the population at large. This became very clear in the 1980 and 1984 elections. One of the interesting features of the group around Reagan is their extraordinary command of public relations. That's basically, you know, there's a strong component of the public relations industry there, and they do their job well. You remember that the campaign rhetoric accused the Democrats of being the party of the special interests. Now, if you look at who they referred to, you'll notice that the special interests were women, blacks, youth, elderly, handicapped, in short, the population. They were the special interests. Only one group didn't qualify as special interests: corporations. And that's right, because they're the national interest. Now, in fact, the claim that the Democrats represent the special interests, that is, the population, is totally false. They also represent the national interest. But what's interesting is the way the elite groups on both sides accept the usage that the population are the special interests and the corporations are the national interest. Term by term, that's the way it works. In order to understand political discourse, you have to bear this in mind and carry out a regular translation procedure of the technical vocabulary. The technical vocabulary is used in the media, in the academic social sciences, and elsewhere to ensure that nothing will be understood about how the society is working and what is happening in the world. And that's, of course, important to preserve democracy, namely a system in which the public doesn't participate. Well, to summarize, let me summarize so far. The right turn is an elite phenomenon. It's not a turn towards conservatism, but rather a turn towards a kind of reactionary jingoism, which is quite the opposite of conservatism. Furthermore, the policies are highly unpopular, and we have extensive poll results which indicate that from the beginning of the Reagan Revolution, the public has been strongly opposed to every major program. So on, say, social spending versus military spending, the public favors cuts in military spending over social spending by ratios like 4-1 or 7-1, depending on the program. On contra aid, the public opposes it by 2-1, and so on, policy by policy. The policies are, in fact, unpopular, and it's not hard to understand why. The public in general is not going to be in favor of policies that turn the state into a welfare state for the rich and that organize a public subsidy for high technology industry, nor are they in favor of interventionism and aggression and so on. Now, the fact that the policies are unpopular causes certain problems, naturally, and there's a classic answer to these problems. And there's a classic answer to this kind of problem. You frighten the population. You threaten them with a great Satan, with an evil empire that's going to destroy them, and then maybe they'll accept the policies as an unfortunate necessity in the face of this threat. However, that also has problems. If you enter into confrontations with the evil empire, it could be dangerous, because they can fight back. So what it's necessary to do is to enter into confrontations with the evil empire's proxies. You find groups around the world that are essentially defenseless, where you can murder them at will and they can't fight back, and you make them the proxies of the evil empire, and then you can attack them. And those confrontations can be used to terrify the domestic population and to ram through unpopular policies. And that's the way it works. For example, Libya has been selected by the Reagan administration public relations people as a perfect target. Defenseless, weak, tiny, kill Libyans at will and nobody cares, given the background of anti-Arab racism, and you can designate them a proxy of the evil empire. And in fact, the Reagan administration has set up regular planned confrontations with the Libyans to try to evoke jingoist hysteria at home and to reinforce the jingoist consensus so that it's possible to carry to pursue these unpopular policies. They've been helped in this by a very effective disinformation apparatus known as the media. Anyhow, that's the way you sell the policy. Terrify the population, but not with confrontations with the evil empire, which is far too dangerous, rather with its designated proxies who are safe because you can attack them at will. The current right turn began in the early 1970s. This was in large part a response to the Vietnam War, which created a number of problems, basically two categories of problems for the elite groups that run the American state and private society. It's a tightly related nexus. One class of problems was economic. The fact of the matter was that the Vietnam War ended up being quite costly to the United States, and it also ended up being quite profitable to our major enemies, that is, our industrial rivals in the First World, the industrial capitalist societies. So it was very profitable for Japan, for example. Just like the Korean War was, the Korean War too was extremely profitable for Japan, and in fact the Korean War and the Vietnam War, where Japan could serve as a source for production and procurement and so on for the American war, that's what created the Japanese economic miracle. What happened was that the costs of the war to our economy translated into gains for the economies of our enemies, Japan, Canada, Western Europe, and so on. That created a serious economic crisis. It meant that U.S. domination of the industrial world was beginning to erode. Now, a number of steps were taken in response to this particular problem. One major step was an attack on labor, drive down wages, an attack on social programs to transfer resources towards the wealthy, towards the investors, and so on. All of this was in the interest of restoring profits and restoring the power of American business quite generally. There's no central dispute over those matters within the sectors that provide planners and policymakers. So that's one class of problems, which leads straight to Reaganism. The second class of problems fall roughly under the category of discipline, and that has to do in part with the Third World. Again, partly because of the Vietnam War, but partly for other reasons, there was a lot of growing lack of discipline in the Third World. There was ferment in Central America, there was a real threat that democracy might develop there, I'll come back to that, and all of these things had to be repressed. The lack of discipline in the Third World had to be stopped and had to be returned to what the Washington Post calls the Central American mode, meaning terror and torture states and so on. And this requires intervention, and intervention requires a jingoist consensus. And that brings us to the second problem of discipline, which is domestic. The population was out of control, dramatically so. The Vietnam War contributed to the politicization of American society. That is, it led to a crisis of democracy. In fact, Crisis of Democracy was the name of the very interesting book written by the Trilateral Commission, their one major publication. And remember that that's a grouping of liberal elites. It's the group around Carter, basically. And in this publication, which is very much worth reading carefully, they describe, it's in 1975, they describe the crisis of democracy. What happened in the 60s, in part because of the Vietnam War and so on, was that segments of the normally apathetic population became organized for political action and tried to enter the political arena. And that, of course, is intolerable, so that has to be stopped, and you got to figure out a way to reduce the public to their traditional apathy and passivity, and it's necessary to overcome the what they call the excesses of the press, which barely existed, but they were frightening, those tiny deviations from obedience, and it is necessary to control what they called the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young, meaning the universities and the schools and so on. And in general, it was necessary to overcome what is called the Vietnam Syndrome. The Vietnam Syndrome, that's a term, it's an interesting term. Syndrome is a disease of some kind. And this refers to the disease that large parts of the population, in fact, a large majority of the population, began to gain some insight into the way the world is working, expressed opposition to aggression and massacre and torture, and a degree of solidarity with their victims. And that's, of course, totally intolerable, just as the crisis of democracy is. And all of that had to be overcome and to restore a jingoist consensus in support of interventionist policies. These are the factors that lie behind the right turn, and because these concerns are shared across liberal and so-called conservative, liberal and jingoist reactionary elites, there being no conservatives to speak of, there is essentially no opposition to the policies. So the right turn then exists, and it had a number of contributory factors, and it has been proceeding with the cooperation of virtually all elite groups. And they are concerned over the threat posed by several major enemies, the first enemy being the industrial rivals of the United States, a second enemy, third world upstarts who are refusing to follow orders and have dangerous ideas about independence, and thirdly, the domestic population, which is always a major enemy, unless it is sufficiently apathetic and controlled. Now, of course, all of this has to be concealed, and it is. It's framed in the conventional Cold War demonology of superpower confrontation. But the fact of the matter is that the Soviet-American conflict, though it's quite real, is only a secondary factor in these developments. It's placed in the forefront, for the reasons I mentioned, in order to frighten the population into obedience. And it would be very hard, for example, to convince Americans that, say, Nicaragua, or peasants in El Salvador, or Libya, or the PLO, constitute a threat to their existence. But if they are all proxies of the evil empire, which is spreading its tentacles and threatening to destroy us, then the threat becomes more credible, and the population can be mobilized to accept such programs as those of the later Carter and Reagan administration, accept them as an unfortunate necessity to save us from destruction. That's basically the way the ideological system works. Now let's take a quick look back to earlier history, and we'll find that this combination is not at all novel. In fact, it's repeatedly happened over and over, and it's worth looking at that to understand it. There have been other so-called right turns. In fact, we find that every major war of this century has evoked a similar reaction on the part of elite groups. That is, business, the political elites that are primarily business-based, the corporate media, and the privileged intelligentsia generally, who serve as the ideological managers or the commissars, as we might call them. After every one of these major wars, there has been a similar campaign on the part of these groups, a similar right turn. So during and after World War I, the Wilson administration, which was called a progressive administration, under the pretext of a Bolshevik threat, launched a Red Scare that succeeded very effectively in deterring the threat of democracy in the true sense, while reinforcing democracy in the technical Orwellian sense. It succeeded in undermining the labor movement, undermining dissident politics, and reinforcing corporate power. There were several lasting institutional effects of the Red Scare, which was quite serious and accepted by a broad elite consensus, including the liberals, who were passionately opposed to freedom of expression and to organizing, and said so quite openly. Two permanent effects of that, institutional effects, were the rise of the public relations industry, which is almost a unique American phenomenon, reflecting the very high level of class consciousness on the part of American business elites. And a second institutional result was the National Political Police, what's called the FBI, which is primarily concerned with suppressing democracy, with suppressing political dissent, organization, activism, and often is commissioned to use violence to do this, as it was by the Kennedy administration and many others. Those two institutions grew out of the effective Red Scare, which did succeed in destroying potentially democratic organizations like, say, labor unions and others, and at least very seriously weakening them and restoring corporate power. It was also, incidentally, at this time that liberal democratic theorists, people like Walter Lippmann, well-known liberal journalist, it's at that time that they began to emphasize what they called, Lippmann in this case, called the manufacture of consent. That is, it's at that time that the explicit theory was developed by elites, and it's worth knowing that it was explicit. The theory that said that in a country where the state does not have the resources to control the population by violence, it's necessary to resort to thought control. In other words, if the voice of the people is heard, you have to make sure that that voice says the right thing. And that requires manufacture of consent, it requires propaganda, it requires indoctrination, it requires public relations, and so on. All of this was developed quite explicitly beginning with the 1920s, and in fact it's a major theme not only of the public relations industry but also of academic social science and what's called democratic theory in the Orwellian sense ever since then. I mean, it's not that that began at that time, but all of this became institutionalized at the time of the Red Scare, using the pretext of a fabricated Bolshevik threat around the end of the First World War and shortly after, in an effort which was successful to avert the crisis of democracy then. Well, the Second World War led to similar developments, the most familiar aspect being the phenomenon that's mislabeled McCarthyism. In fact, it was a broad-based effort spearheaded at first by liberal Democrats with a strong support of the by then very well-organized public relations industry. The point was to overcome the crisis of democracy that was then brewing during and after the Second World War. And again, it was quite conscious. It was conscious through the latter period of the Depression and later. In 1938, the National Association of Manufacturers Board of Directors concluded, I'm now quoting, concluded that the hazard facing industrialists is the newly realized political power of the masses. Unless their thinking is directed, they said, we are definitely headed for adversity. Notice, incidentally, that business groups, when they're talking to one another, quite often use vulgar Marxist rhetoric like this. That's not uncommon. And in fact, substantial efforts were taken by the highly class-conscious business groups to overcome the threat, namely the newly realized political power of the masses, which was, again, a crisis of democracy. Well, the point of these comments is that wars and other periods of turmoil, like depressions, they tend to involve people in social and political action. They tend to create a crisis of democracy, a threat of political organization and engagement on the part of the population, that is, a threat that there might be moves towards meaningful democracy, and naturally dominant elites have to rally to prevent this threat to privilege and power. So we get the Red Scare during and after World War I, the post-World War II repression and PR campaign, which was quite serious, and the right turn of the post-Vietnam decade, which we're now in the midst of. In all three cases, one major enemy was the domestic population, that is, the special interests, as they're called in contemporary newspeak. They have to be returned to apathy and passivity. In all three cases, the Bolshevik threat was used quite effectively for this purpose. Before the Bolsheviks were around, it was necessary to appeal to other threats to accomplish similar purposes. So when Wilson invaded the Dominican Republic in Haiti in 1915 and 16, there were no Bolsheviks around, so we were defending ourselves against the Huns at that time. And throughout our earlier history, we were defending ourselves against Great Britain as we slaughtered the native population and conquered the national territory, a major theme of U.S. history, incidentally, from the earliest days. Well, I've talked so far about how the groups that control the economy and the state and the ideological institutions react to threats to their power and privilege, the threats raised by one primary enemy, namely the domestic population, the special interests. But there are, of course, other enemies that have to be confronted. The industrial powers of the First World, Europe, Japan, and so on, and their populations, and as I mentioned, they were getting out of control after the Second World War, the peoples of the Third World, and the Soviet Union. So how were these challenges addressed by American planners? Let's begin with World War II. At the end of World War II, the United States had a degree of wealth and power relative to others that has no historical parallel to it. The United States literally had about half of the world's wealth. During World War II, most of our industrial rivals were either severely weakened or totally destroyed, while the World War was very beneficial to the United States. Our territory, of course, was never under attack. And in fact, American industrial production quadrupled or tripled or quadrupled, depending on which measure you pick, during the Second World War. And in fact, long before the Second World War, we already had been the greatest industrial power in the world. Furthermore, there were no enemies. The United States had no enemies in the hemisphere. It controlled both oceans. It controlled most of the opposite sides of both oceans. There has never been a period in history when one power had such overwhelming control of the world's wealth or such overwhelming security. That naturally created a new situation.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky on The Right Turn. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Well, American planners understood it. They understood all of that. And they were determined to keep things that way. There was a spectrum of opinion. This, incidentally, is a very open society by comparative standards. We have a rich documentary record. You have to work to find it because it's excluded from the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young, as the liberal ideologists call them. But it's there. It's there if you forget the history books and the political science texts and so on, and you go back to the documentary record, you find a lot of riches. The picture looks approximately like this. There was an elite consensus that the dominance of the United States had to be maintained, but there was a spectrum of opinion as to how to do it, roughly hawks and doves. At the hardline extreme, you have documents such as the National Security Council Memorandum 68. These are all top secret documents, but they've been released, 30 years later and so on, so they're now available. NSC 68 in 1950, written by Paul Nitze, that's the hardline extreme. It's important to bear in mind that this document was prior to the Korean War. It was in April 1950, before it was not a response to the Korean War. It preceded it. NSC 68 called for a huge increase in the military system. The actual figures behind it were maybe tripling or more of the military system. It called for a rollback strategy against the Soviet Union, a policy designed to break the Soviet Union up and to take it over. The wording was the following, I'm quoting it now, The policy was designed to foster the seeds of destruction within the Soviet system by a variety of means, which would enable the United States, quote, to negotiate a settlement with the Soviet Union or a successor state or states. Now, this policy of breaking up the Soviet Union required, they said, sacrifice and discipline in the United States. It required cutback, huge military expenditures, cutback of social measures. It required that we take measures to overcome what they called the excess of tolerance or domestic dissent. In other words, you got to control the citizens and, you know, impose totalitarian discipline and, in general, prevent the threat of democratic politics. That's the hardline extreme. It's only what kind of means were they talking about? Well, the means were, in fact, being used. They weren't just being talked about. They were being used, in fact, prior to this. They were using, for example, such means as U.S. support for armies fighting inside the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe, armies that had been established and encouraged by Hitler, which were now being supported with CIA agents and airdrops and so on. This also involved things like turning over West German intelligence to a network run by Reinhard Gehlen, who was in charge of Nazi military intelligence on the Eastern Front. So reconstitute the Nazi network for the Eastern Front. These were the measures that were already in place prior to the NSC 68. All of this is known in the United States, but considered insignificant. We might react a little bit differently, let's say, if we found that the Soviet Union in 1950 was supporting armies in the Rockies established by Hitler and dropping agents and supplies to them. But we consider it our right, since we own the world, we consider it our right to do anything anywhere, whereas others plainly don't have equivalent rights. So that's the hardline extreme, and notice that the policies were being implemented. Well, let's turn to the doves. Let's turn to the other extreme. The leading dovish figure was undoubtedly George Kennan. He headed the State Department planning staff until 1950, at which time he was replaced by Paul Nitze. That was a switch from the dovish to the hawkish extreme of the spectrum. Kennan was one of the major figures in shaping the post-war world. He is also one of the most humane and intelligent and also lucid of state planners, and therefore what he wrote is extremely interesting to illustrate the dovish extreme. I've sampled the hawkish extreme. For example, one document which you ought to look at if you want to understand your country is PPS 23, Policy Planning Study 23, published by the State Department planning staff, written by George Kennan, top secret, of course, February 1948. Here's what it says. I'll now quote it. We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford today the luxury of altruism and world benefaction. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives, such as human rights, the raising of the living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we're going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are then hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. Now, that, of course, is a top secret document. To pacify the public, it's necessary to trumpet the idealistic slogans, as is done constantly. But here, planners are talking to one another. Now, these prescriptions, in fact, referred to the Far East, but the United States is a global power, and the same principles apply elsewhere, as Kennan and others explained. So, for example, in a briefing for Latin American ambassadors in 1950, Kennan observed that a major concern of U.S. foreign policy must be, I'm quoting, the protection of our raw materials. Notice, our raw materials. Again, this is secret, so you can be open about it. To protect our resources, we have to combat a dangerous heresy which had been detected by U.S. intelligence shortly before and which they said was spreading through Latin America, namely, quote, the wide acceptance of the idea that the government has direct responsibility for the welfare of the people. That's what's called communism, whatever the political commitments of the advocates, they can be church-based self-help groups or whatever, but they're communists if they fall under this heresy. Again, another term of newspeak. Well, Kennan went on to explain the means that we have to use against our enemies who fall prey to this heresy that threatens our resources, which happen to be in their countries. Quote, "The final answer might be an unpleasant one, but we should not hesitate before police repression by the local government. This is not shameful, since the communists are essentially traitors. It's better to have a strong regime in power than a liberal government if it is indulgent and relaxed and penetrated by communists." Again, term communist being used in the technical sense. Remember, I'm sampling the dovish side of the spectrum here. Well, these views illustrate the spectrum of opinion among planners, and the documentary record pretty well falls within that spectrum, as you can discover by checking it. Occasionally, you can find some qualifications. So, for example, there's an influential study of April 1947, secret again, which observed that, about aid, it observed that foreign aid should be restricted to countries of, I'm quoting now, countries of primary strategic importance to the United States, excepting in those rare instances which present an opportunity for the United States to gain worldwide approbation by an act strikingly humanitarian. Now, this stance, again, is not unique to the United States, and it did not arise in the post-war period. So let's return to Woodrow Wilson, who, as you know, was the great apostle of self-determination and who celebrated this doctrine by invading Mexico and invading Haiti and the Dominican Republic, where his warriors murdered and destroyed, reestablished virtual slavery, demolished the political system while establishing the basis for murderous and corrupt dictatorships, and placed the area firmly into the hands of U.S. investors. Well, Kennan's nutshell presentation of U.S. foreign policy did not emerge from a vacuum. It reflected a much broader geopolitical analysis that had been developed by elite groups and planning studies through the war. There were study groups of the State Department, including virtually all their top planners, and the Council on Foreign Relations, which provides the main business input into foreign policy planning through the war, 1939 to 1945, and they formulated kind of a theory of what the post-war world should look like. They formulated the concept of what they called the grand area, a region which they said should be subordinated to the needs of the American economy. It should include the Western Hemisphere, the Far East, the former British Empire, which was being dismantled and subordinated to the United States. It was to be extended to a total global system, if possible, surely including Western Europe and the incomparable energy resources of the Middle East, which were then passing into American hands as we pushed out our rivals, France and England. Now, these guiding geopolitical conceptions explain a good deal of what has been happening in the world. If they're not understood, what takes place will appear to be a series of random errors, inconsistencies, confusions, traceable to the failings of a political leadership that is in fact succeeding quite brilliantly in its assigned chores. The Third World was to be incorporated within the grand area, so was Europe. Europe posed problems, but Soviet aggression was considered a very remote eventuality. The CIA concluded in 1947 that the problem of Europe was not Soviet aggression, which no intelligence expected, but rather the possibility of economic collapse in Western Europe and the consequent accession to power of communist elements. It's one reason for the Marshall Plan, which was also motivated by the needs of U.S. industry for export markets and overseas investment. That came out of Kennan's office, incidentally. Let me just note that the United States, contrary to what everyone says, left and right, contrary to what virtually everyone says, the United States achieved its major objectives in Indochina. That was a partial victory for the United States. No successes in Indochina will infect the region. The kind of economic and social development that American planners were very much afraid of in the late 1950s and early 60s, particularly in South Vietnam, and remember, South Vietnam was the main target of the American attack throughout, and the United States won its war against South Vietnam. No successes there will infect the region. And post-1975 U.S. policy has, in fact, been designed to maximize repression and suffering in the countries that were devastated by U.S. violence. The degree of the cruelty of this is quite astonishing if you look at the details. For example, when the Mennonites tried to send pencils to Cambodia, the State Department stopped them. When Oxfam tried to send 10 solar pumps, government stopped them. When religious groups tried to send shovels to Laos to try to dig up some of the unexploded ordnance left by the American bombing, the government tried to stop them. When India tried to send 100 buffalo to Vietnam to replace the huge buffalo herds that were destroyed by the American attack, and remember, this is a primitive country. Buffaloes means fertilizer, tractors, and so on. The United States threatened to cancel Food for Peace aid. That's one that Orwell would have appreciated. Meanwhile, while the United States was extirpating the cancer at its source, the threat of successful development in South Vietnam and elsewhere at its source, it buttressed what was called the second line of defense, for example, by supporting the Suharto takeover in Indonesia with some 500,000 killed in a few months in 1965, backing the overthrow of Philippine democracy in 1972, supporting martial law in South Korea, again in 1972, again under Carter in 1980, and so on. Well, in accordance with the reigning geopolitical conceptions, right at the end of World War II, the United States turned at once to dealing with the problem faced, with a major problem faced by the population of the world, which had been politicized by the war, namely the problem faced by the anti-fascist resistance. The anti-fascist resistance in the liberated regions had to be suppressed, and the United States turned to that task globally, often suppressing it in favor of Nazi and fascist collaborators. This, in fact, is a major theme of early post-war history, which is barely discussed. It ought to be chapter one in an honest history of the post-war period, but you really have to look into the technical monographs to find it. What was the problem? Well, the primary concern is one that had been formulated by one of Winston Churchill's closest advisors, Jan Christian Smuts, South African prime minister. He pointed out to Churchill in 1943 that with politics let loose among those peoples, we may have a wave of disorder and wholesale communism set going all over those parts of Europe. Communism, again, in the technical sense. Neither so-called communism nor socialism nor national capitalism was tolerable, and they had to be destroyed. The pattern was set in the first area liberated, North Africa, where President Roosevelt installed in power Admiral Jean Darlan, who was a leading Nazi collaborator and the author of the Vichy anti-Semitic laws. As U.S. forces advanced through Italy, they restored the essential structure of the fascist regime and dispersed the resistance, which had fought courageously against six Nazi divisions. In Greece, the United States entered under the guise of the Truman Doctrine, launching the first major post-World War II war of insurgency, a very murderous war with maybe 160,000 killed, complete with torture, political exile for tens of thousands of people, re-education camps, as we called them, for tens of thousands of others, destruction of unions and any political independent politics, and the full range of means that were later used in similar exercises throughout the world, placing the country firmly in the hands of U.S. investors and local business elites, while in fact much of the population had to emigrate in order to survive. The beneficiaries again included Nazi collaborators, while the primary victims were the workers and the peasants of the communist-led anti-Nazi resistance. Well, the same pattern was followed elsewhere. It was a global pattern. A fascist coup in Colombia, which was inspired by Franco's Spain, aroused no concern in the United States, no more than a military coup in Venezuela or the restoration of an admirer of fascism in Panama. But the first democratic government in the history of Guatemala, which modeled itself on Roosevelt's New Deal, elicited bitter U.S. antagonism, and a CIA coup that turned Guatemala into a literal hell on earth, kept that way since, with regular U.S. intervention and support, particularly under Kennedy and Johnson, and including the Carter years, when, contrary to what is commonly alleged, U.S. military aid never ceased and was barely below the norm. Under Reagan, support for near genocide in Guatemala became positively euphoric, and the most extreme of these series of Guatemalan Himmlers that we backed there, Rios Montt, was lauded by Reagan as a man totally dedicated to democracy who was getting a bum rap also lauded by Elliot Abrams, Gene Kirkpatrick, and other enthusiastic supporters of Pol Pot-style atrocities, which is in fact what was going on there at the time, with maybe 75,000 people slaughtered and others tortured and raped, etc., during that period, a couple of years. One aspect of this post-war project of suppressing the anti-fascist resistance, often in favor of fascist collaborators, one aspect of it was the recruitment of war criminals, people like Klaus Barbie. He had been responsible, the Butcher of Lyon, as he's called. He was responsible for many crimes in France, so he was naturally placed in charge of spying on the French for U.S. intelligence. The reasons for this were cogently explained by Barbie's superior, Colonel Eugene Kolb of U.S. intelligence. He noted that Barbie's skills were badly needed, he said, I'm quoting, "To our knowledge, his activities had been directed against the underground French Communist Party and the resistance, just as we in the post-war era were concerned with the German Communist Party and activities inimical to American policies in Germany." That's right, the comment is quite apt. The United States was picking up where the Nazis had left off, and it was therefore entirely natural that they should employ specialists in anti-resistance activities. Later on, when it became difficult or impossible to protect these useful folk in Europe, many of them were spirited off to the United States or to Latin America with the help of the Vatican and fascist priests. There they have engaged in terrorism, coups, the drug and armaments trade, training the apparatus of the U.S.-backed national security states modeled on the Nazis in Latin America, training them in methods of torture devised by the Gestapo, and so on. Some of their students have found their way to Central America, establishing a direct link between the death camps and the death squads via the U.S.-SS post-war alliance. Now, I can't run through the whole record case by case, but let me mention a few general points. We might ask how well George Kennan's precepts were followed. Recall George Kennan, the dovish advice, again in top secret documents, that in order to maintain the disparity, we put aside all concern for vague and unrealistic ideas such as human rights, the raising of the living standards, and democratization. How well have we lived up to that? Well, it's an empirical question, and it has indeed been studied. So if you take human rights, there are studies relating the human rights climate to American aid, and there's a correlation, impressive correlation. Let me quote from Lars Schultz, who's the leading U.S. academic specialist on human rights in Latin America. He discovered in one study that U.S. aid has tended to flow disproportionately to Latin American governments which torture their citizens, to the hemisphere's relatively egregious violators of fundamental human rights. Furthermore, he shows the correlation is strong, includes military aid, extends through the Carter years, and is unexplained by any relation between aid and need. These facts, you might think, would be of some concern to people who care about their country. Let's turn to the raising of the living standards. Now, quite regularly, in areas of predominant U.S. influence, such as Latin America, there has been statistical growth in the course of what are called economic miracles, while much of the population starves as croplands are diverted to export production for the benefit of U.S. agribusiness and local elites. That's true throughout Central America. Kennedy's Alliance for Progress gave a significant impetus to these destructive, in fact, if we were honest, murderous developments. And there's a corollary to the Alliance for Progress style of development. It's necessary to institute terror and torture states with an efficient apparatus of repression to suppress the popular opposition that develops when you pursue such development policies. The structure of the death squads in El Salvador, for example, was established at that time. Countries that have attempted to reverse the pattern, such as Guatemala under the democratic capitalist regime of Arevalo and Arbenz, or the Dominican Republic under the also democratic capitalist regime of Bosch or Nicaragua today, naturally they are the target of U.S. hostility and violence. As for democratization, the historical record reveals exactly what a rational observer would expect. If you look at the case of, say, Guatemala in 1954, where a democratic capitalist government was overthrown by a CIA coup, or 1963, when Kennedy backed a military coup to prevent the threat of renewed democracy, or Chile or the Dominican Republic in 1963 or 1965, and many others, you will discover that U.S. elites have consistently opposed formal parliamentary democracy. if its results cannot be controlled. And they have evinced outright hatred for democracy at home as well, incidentally, if by democracy we mean a system that allows the mass of the population to participate in some meaningful way in the formation of state policy. These facts, incidentally, have not gone unnoticed by serious scholars. Well, the recent history of the United States in Central America illustrates all of these themes. Let me just mention some obvious truths. The real reasons for the attack against Nicaragua are explained by the charitable development organization Oxfam, the major charitable development organization which works in many parts of the third world. Oxfam America points out that among the four countries of Central America where Oxfam America works, namely El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, only in Nicaragua has a substantial effort been made to address inequities in land ownership and to extend health, educational, and agricultural services to poor peasant families. But the Contra war has slowed the pace of social reform and compounded the burden in the countryside, leading to hunger and a return to earlier conditions, so that now Americans who are enthusiastic supporters of starvation and torture can point to those failures as a justification for further atrocities, as they regularly do. This was all a major success for the United States. Well, let me just say a word about security policy since it's late, and I don't want to leave the topic unmentioned. The Pentagon system has long been the technique by which the state mobilizes public resources to subsidize advanced sectors of industry. Now, there are very good reasons, which business elites, incidentally, have articulated very clearly since the late 1940s, as to why these methods are to be preferred over other devices of public subsidy for so-called private enterprise. Contrary to what's often said, the beneficiaries are not primarily military industry, rather general high technology industry. So take, say, computers, the foundation of any modern society. In the 1950s, when computers were not commercially marketable, they were paid for by the public. The public paid for the cost of the costly period of research and development and early production through the military system in the 1950s. In the 1960s, when computers became marketable, it was handed over to so-called private enterprise, which had already been subsidized so that they could make the profits. And that continues right now. So the so-called fifth generation computers, next big computer development, that's funded virtually entirely by the public through the Pentagon, NASA, which is basically a Pentagon-related enterprise, and the Department of Energy in connection with the production of nuclear weapons. And the same is true of a wide range of other advanced technologies. Now, if you understand these things, you can very well understand and predict, in fact, U.S. policies on arms control and related matters. The comparative advantage of the United States is not production any longer, rather technological innovation. Now, it's sometimes argued that this planning is lunatic, and it's true, but it's totally irrelevant. In government, as in business, it's a short-range system. You don't have long-term planning. The longer term is someone else's concern. If you think about it, you'll notice that that's quite natural in a competitive society, where those who do not devote themselves to short-term advantage are unlikely to be around in the long run. And these same attitudes are taken over when the same corporate managers become state planners. So we should not at all be surprised at the fact that in the 1950s, the United States made no effort to terminate the development of ICBMs, which were the only weapons that could threaten it. These factors are not the concern of planners. Rather, their concern is to maintain the disparity, to prevent rotten apples from infecting others, to ensure the crucial right to rob and to exploit, and to guarantee the domestic system of public subsidy and private profit called free enterprise. Now, the public may express overwhelming support for a nuclear freeze and cuts in military rather than social spending, as in fact it does, but this too is an irrelevance, as is the clear feasibility of a nuclear freeze, a comprehensive test ban, a ban on missile testing, and other measures which would surely enhance the possibilities of survival and be very beneficial to the security of the United States. As every serious study of the American political system recognizes, the public has little voice in such matters, and public opinion is of no more concern to elite groups that control the state apparatus than security or survival or human rights, the raising of the living standards and democratization. Not only the people of Latin America, but also those of the rest of the world, including the United States, are an incident, not an end, in the words that so impressed Woodrow Wilson. This is not because the leadership are bad people, and none of it is likely to change very much if better people take their place. The reasons are institutional, and the problems should be confronted without illusions, with understanding of the social realities. Thank you.
You were just listening to Noam Chomsky on The Right Turn. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at the University of Colorado in Boulder in 1986. Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist, has been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. During Alternative Radio's 40th anniversary year, we'll be airing more Chomsky classics from our archives. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent, unembedded nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Noam Chomsky on The Right Turn, and for his book, The Myth of American Idealism, How U.S. Foreign Policy Endangers the World, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Today, we have a special episode with Professor David Shumway of the Literature Department at Carnegie Mellon University. He studies film. Thanks for coming on the show, Professor.
My pleasure.
Yeah, so you could tell us a little bit about yourself to get us started.
Well, I've been writing and studying about film since my days in graduate school at Indiana University in the 1970s. I've taught film at Carnegie Mellon since the mid-80s. I was involved in starting the film minor here and then in starting the film major. I've written about film in a number of different contexts, published in Cinema Journal. I have a book about the film director John Sayles. I have books about romance, where I write about romantic comedies and romance films like Casablanca and Gone with the Wind. So I have broad interest in cinema, especially American, but...
So what attracted you to studying cinema in the first place?
Well, when I was in high school, I was interested in the arts, in especially in novels, which I regarded as a significant art form, but kind of realized at that point that it seemed as though the most interesting artists working at that moment were not novelists, but filmmakers. That was on the heels of the French New Wave and other important European directors who had really made a big splash here, and the beginning of the American auteur movement with people like Martin Scorsese and others making their first movies.
When would you say that change happened, when sort of the chief artists of a generation became the filmmakers?
Sometime in the 60s. I mean, there were great artists earlier, but they weren't generally recognized as such.
Mm-hmm. So I'll ask you a question you probably get a lot. What's your favorite movie to come out in 2024 so far?
Oh, in 2024?
Or any recent movie.
So what? Maybe my favorite movie in 2024 is Between the Temples, an independent film about a young cantor who is trying to figure out both his wife has recently died, so it's about his emotions.